Welcome to episode 4 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe & Johnson. Thanks for joining us. We are lawyers talking about technology, security, privacy, and government. And I'm joined today by Jason Weinstein, one of our regulars, formerly with the Justice Department, where he oversaw criminal computer crime prosecutions, among other things, and is now doing criminal and civil litigation here at Steptoe. We've got a guest commentator in Chris Conti, formerly with Steptoe, and then for 15 years or more with the SEC, and now back at Steptoe, I'm pleased to say. It's kind of scary that I was here when you left, here when you come back, and you've had a whole career. Finally, I'm delighted to say that we'll be doing our interview at the end of the news roundup with David Medin, the chairman of the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board, which just released a 200-plus page report on NSA and the telephony metadata collection program. David's got a distinguished history at both the FTC and in private practice, and is a thoughtful commentator, notwithstanding the fact that we completely disagree on this program. So let's get started on the roundup. I've told you the biggest piece of news for the week, which is the PCLOB, the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board report, which holds, which declares that in the view of a majority of the board, the program that NSA has been running for close to 10 years is a violation of the statute under which it is now organized and should be abandoned, and a variety of other somewhat less controversial declarations. We'll be covering those when David joins us at the end of the roundup. The other kind of mildly interesting new development, not quite in our wheelhouse, but close enough, is the Supreme Court granted certiorari on two cases involving searches of cell phones incident to arrest. So there's always been, you know, whenever you arrest somebody, you search everything he's carrying, and the police have been searching the phones of everybody they arrest. It's just that they're finding more and more stuff because the phones have more and more stuff on them, and that has produced a split in the circuits, and now the Supreme Court has taken, what, two cases, Jason?
That's right.
What do we know about the cases? What do we think this is going to do to the law?
Well, there was a split among several federal circuits and among the courts in several states, and so perhaps it's appropriate that the Supreme Court agreed to take one federal and one state case. The state case involved a smartphone, and the federal case involved a more traditional flip phone that had less data on it. In the state case, which is called Riley versus California, the defendant was stopped in a traffic stop in 2009 while driving with expired tags, and he was later found to have a suspended license. So his car was impounded, and the police did what they always do in these situations when they impound a vehicle. They did what's called an inventory search of that vehicle, except in this case, the inventory search revealed that the guy had concealed weapons in the car. So he was arrested, and his phone, which is a Samsung smartphone, was seized incident to arrest. The officer searched the phone without a warrant, I think two separate times, under the search incident to arrest doctrine, and they found evidence linking him to a gang shooting, and he was later convicted based on some of the evidence that was found on the phone. On appeal, he argued that the search of the phone violated the Fourth Amendment. The California Court of Appeals actually disagreed and affirmed the conviction, and California's highest court decided not to take the case, but now the Supreme Court has, and they're going to decide whether the evidence admitted in his trial was obtained from an illegal search of his phone. The other case, the federal case from Boston, a case called United States versus Worry, which involved a defendant who was arrested in an open-air parking lot in Boston doing a drug deal. His phone was seized incident to arrest, and while at the police station, the officers noticed that on the external screen of the phone, it was a flip phone, he was getting multiple calls from a number identified as my house, and since I'm on the radio, I'll indicate that I'm using air quotes, since it wasn't actually from my house. The officers looked at the call log and they wrote down the number of my house, and they used it to find the address of his house. They got a warrant for the house and found a significant amount of crack cocaine, and he's now doing a significant amount of federal time for that crack cocaine. The First Circuit actually threw out the conviction and said that it was the search incident to arrest exception to the Fourth Amendment doesn't authorize a warrantless search of his cell phone, and now the Supreme Court has to decide who's right, the district judge or the First Circuit. The tension is that the government's position is, as you alluded to it in the intro, it's fairly well established that law enforcement can search any item found in the person of an arrested individual so long as the search is not conducted in an unreasonable manner, and that's in law enforcement circles known as the search incident to arrest doctrine. Now, when these cases are argued in April and then decided after that, we're going to find out what the Supreme Court thinks about the limits of that doctrine and whether it applies to devices that contain tremendous amounts of personal information that literally everybody is carrying with them, whether or not they're using those devices in connection with the commission of a crime. And it's a fascinating question because it raises interesting technological as well as legal questions. The search incident to arrest exception is about two things. It's about protecting officer safety. It was designed to allow officers to seize weapons the person might have on the person, and about preventing the destruction of evidence. When I was a federal prosecutor, the general rule that we followed was that we would allow officers to do the limited search necessary to avoid losing evidence that could be lost from a cell phone. So if the phone directory contains 20 numbers, as each new call comes in, you could push out the most, the 20th received call, and that call would be lost forever. So we would allow officers, before going to get a warrant, to actually write down the last 20 numbers called. There would be no need for them to go and write down the address book if the address book isn't going anywhere. And so we would require them to go get a warrant for that evidence that wasn't going to be at risk of being destroyed. It's potentially much more complicated with smartphones, not only because they contain so much more information of different types, but also because the technology exists to allow them to be wiped remotely. So a phone could be seized and an accomplice could wipe the phone while the officers are waiting to go get a warrant issued. Now, they could presumably put it into airplane mode, or they could turn it off, take the battery out to defeat the remote wipe attempt. But law enforcement forensics people will tell you that sometimes your best chance of getting data from a password-protected phone is to keep it on. Because when you power it down,
keep it turning over the screen every once in a while.
Exactly. Because if you turn it off and if you take the battery out, then when you come back on, if you don't have the password, there are significant limitations on law enforcement's ability to actually search it if they get a warrant to do so. So I suspect what will happen is the court will took these cases because it wants to articulate that the search incident to arrest exception, if it means anything, it means that officers should only be taking the steps necessary to preserve evidence that actually could be lost, and that they should be expected to take reasonable steps to preserve evidence otherwise pending the issuance of a warrant. Given that everybody carries these devices around, regardless of whether they're used in the commission of a crime, and given the volume of information on them, I suspect what the court will say is, in the immediate aftermath of an arrest, you have to take reasonable steps to preserve the evidence. If that means airplane mode, it means airplane mode. If it means recording certain transitory information like I described earlier with call logs, you can do that, but otherwise you've got to preserve it, freeze it, and then go get a warrant to search it. But it'll be very interesting to see what the court does.
I predict that the notion that phones need to be different because they've got so much information, especially smartphones, is going to turn out to be Vietnam for the Roberts Court. They are going to find themselves saying, oh, well, this is really a big deal, and then the question is, well, what isn't a big deal, and exactly how big a deal? It's going to be a mess, but this is the first step. This is the first landing on the beach at Da Nang, and we'll see if they decide to continue with the beachhead. So, second question, and I'm going to ask Chris to talk about this, is the Securities and Exchange Commission released its national examination priorities just earlier this month and made cybersecurity a priority. Chris, what does this mean? Exactly how big a deal is this?
Well, I think it's a significant development. What it means is that the SEC examiners will be going in and speaking to the entities that are registered with the SEC, like broker-dealers, investment companies, investment advisors, And they're going to be looking in two different ways at cyber-related and technology-related issues. One is really at the board level, if you will, where they're going to be looking at governance and supervision of information technology systems, information security. That's, you know, from a corporate-wide basis, how are you assessing your information risks, which would include cyber risks, and your reporting mechanisms to identify when those risks occur. More particularly, they're also cited that in broker-dealers, you've seen instances where entities or individuals have been able to hack into trading systems and take over customer accounts and engage in manipulations and fraud. And so they're going to be focusing on that level as well. But Mary Jo White in October spoke publicly about how cybersecurity will continue and remain an issue of significant focus to the SEC. And I think the exam staff going into the regulated entities that they review will begin to gather and assess information about their preparedness and readiness and disclosures. And that information will begin to filter back to the agency as they get, as they grow with their appreciation and understanding of just how prepared issuers are to address these kinds of risks.
So that's interesting. So this is not going to affect companies in their quarterly reports and public disclosures to investors. This is about people who are regulated by the SEC. Is that right?
Right. Although some regulated entities could also be issuers as well, but that's right.
And one of the things this does is it makes the SEC a little smarter about cybersecurity in today's world, which God knows they need it.
Well, that's exactly right. And if there are really real deficiencies in what the SEC expects should be done, there's always the chance that the exam program will begin to start talking to the enforcement program about failures to rectify deficiencies. And so you're inching closer to enforcement division land than you are exam land.
Because the enforcers can always call up the examiners and say, these guys didn't do this. Is that a big deal or not? And the examiners will say, nobody we examined failed to do that.
Yeah, well, the exam staff and the enforcement staff collaborate, on a regular basis. So there's a lot of information shared there.
All right. Thanks, Chris. Pleasure to have you on. Third, Verizon issued its transparency report recently. This is all the rage among telecom and internet service providers, started by Google and followed now by practically every brand name in the field. Verizon's transparency report discloses the number of government demands for information about customers that they received in 2013. And the total is 320,000 law enforcement requests, about half of them subpoenas, and another 60,000 of them something indistinguishable from subpoenas. They also got some real-time billing information requests, about 6,000 of those, 1,500 wiretap orders, and some warrants, which they said were mostly, but not exclusively, about getting content, probably electronic content, and then about 50,000 emergency requests from law enforcement. There it is, 300,000. I'm not sure what anybody is supposed to make of this. It sounds like a lot, and it is more than last year, they say. I'm not convinced that we're getting any real value out of reading this, maybe in the long run there'll be some valuable trends that people can spot. The national security letters they gave as a range between 1,000 and 2,000. Jason, any surprises in this?
I actually, 300,000 sounds like a lot until you actually break it down and put in perspective that this is law enforcement at all levels. This is federal, state, local, in every corner of the United States. And given how prevalent phone use is by everybody, it stands to reason it's also quite prevalent among criminals who are being investigated. It is, step one or step two on any law enforcement officer's to-do list when they're doing a criminal investigation to get phone records to try to map out a criminal suspect's associations. And and to use that data to then further investigate. So given how it's a core investigative technique to go get even basic phone records, this number didn't strike me as really high at all.
Okay, so on to the FTC, which got consent decrees from a dozen companies for falsely claiming that they complied with the International Safe Harbor. It's not clear exactly how much of a punishment was involved, and it may be unclear exactly how intentional this was. It looks as though a lot of these guys had announced when they joined the Safe Harbor that they were part of it and then let their membership lapse. Jason, what do we know about this?
Strikes me as the functional equivalent of signing up for a free membership to something and then forgetting to cancel it after a month.
I'll date myself by saying I remember being part of a record club like that.
I was going to go record club, but I don't want to date myself. So, you know, as we talked about in last week's podcast, as part of the rhetoric between the EU and the U.S. over the future of Safe Harbor, one of the complaints from the EU has been that there is, in their view, weak enforcement of Safe Harbor by the FTC and by U.S. authorities. So perhaps it's not a coincidence that the FTC is trying to create the impression that it's being aggressive in enforcing Safe Harbor, but there's less here than actually meets the eye. The settlements are with 12 companies in a cross-section of industries, three NFL teams, including the Falcons, Titans, and the Broncos, so good teams and bad, retail, medical labs, debt collection, perhaps somewhat ironically a couple of data security firms. As you know, companies self-certify to the Department of Commerce each year that they're in compliance with Safe Harbor. And the allegation here is not that these companies committed any substantive privacy violation whatsoever or that they were not, in fact, in compliance with Safe Harbor. It's simply that they allowed their certifications to lapse but continued to make statements on their websites, either through the displaying of a certificate or through affirmative statements that they were still in compliance with Safe Harbor. So they've agreed not to do that anymore, not to misrepresent the extent of their compliance. And of course, a violation of the consent decree could result in civil penalties. But it's more of a sin of omission than commission. And one can only hope this doesn't interfere with the Broncos' preparation for the Super Bowl.
Safe Harbor is a great deal for U.S. companies. It answers so many questions that otherwise will cost you tens of thousands, if not more, in legal fees. It's a great thing to do. You just need to make sure that your calendar includes a renewal reminder. Okay, now on to my favorite story of the week and really of the year, because it involves hookers, orgies, sadomasochism, and the peculiarities of the Europeans, if that isn't redundant. The story is this. And I forgot Nazis. Max Mosley is a former head of the Formula One Racing Association. His dad was a notorious Nazi sympathizer in England during the 30s and really into the 40s. Mosley sort of chose a different path, made quite a bit of money, and after leaving the Formula One racing, seems to have engaged in what I think is fair to describe as a five-hour, five-hooker, sadomasochistic orgy. And one of the hookers filmed it and gave the film to the British press, which ran with the pictures and called it a five-hour, five-hooker, sadomistic, masochistic orgy with a Nazi theme, which obviously he was sort of sensitive about, apparently the only thing he was really sensitive about. So he sued and got an apology because although there were a bunch of women wearing prison costumes, there was no Nazi theme to the event. And now he is going around in a remarkably self-defeating move, trying to get Google to stop releasing the pictures of him in his altogether engaged in this orgy, and getting you know, injunctions from French courts. And recently, what makes this newsworthy again is he got a German court to enjoin Google from releasing those photos in response to searches. Utterly self-defeating, because he's only increasing the number of hits that he gets on this, but he's aging and everybody has to have a hobby in their retirement, and this seems, well, he's got two now. So I awarded him a nomination for the Dubious Achievements in Privacy Law for his French litigation. It looks like he's going to be a repeat nominee in the privies this year. That brings me to a second. I decided we should reopen the privies for next year so that people can make nominations, and I've already found one nominee, the University of North Carolina Tar Heels, for abusing privacy law in pursuit of privilege and power. Basically, a researcher at the University of North Carolina used the reading scores of some of her student athlete charges to determine what the average reading score capability of a Tar Heel athlete was, and found that the 60% of them were between 4th and 8th grade. That produced an enormous black eye for the UNC, and naturally they blamed her as opposed to their recruiters. And as soon as they had a chance to look at her research, they discovered that she had kept track of their names so that she could look at their grade point averages as well as their reading scores. And the Institutional Review Board at the University of North Carolina said, you can't do that. It's a violation of their privacy. She said, I didn't give it to anybody until the administration demanded the names from me. The Institutional Review Board said, that doesn't matter. Just having the names is a violation of their privacy. You can't continue this research. Conveniently, your entire research project is suspended until the end of basketball season. She's not going to prevail, even though they said she's welcome to apply for approval again. My suggestion was that she needs to find somebody equally powerful, not just appeal to the law. So I'm hoping that she will apply for approval from the Institutional Review Board at Duke. Okay. There's a story that just barely made it into the week. A fellow went to the movies in Ohio wearing Google Glass. He's watching the movie. He's halfway through when a guy badges him, grabs the glasses off his face and hauls him out to a four-hour semi-detention interview. I think they said, well, you're free to go, but bad things will happen. The agency that did that, apparently enforcing some kind of motion picture policy against people who've been taping movies in their first run, was the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, part of DHS. Now, I was kind of wondering why they had the time to do this, and I know Jason was in charge of all of that intellectual property enforcement, so I thought I'd give him a chance to justify this silly behavior on the part of ICE.
Okay, well, I don't know if that'll do that, but I can explain it a little bit. So this poor guy must have thought he was in the middle of a 4D movie experience. He goes to see a movie about a federal agent and finds himself being investigated by federal agents in the middle of the movie. It was actually a big week for law enforcement interventions with Google Glasses. Just last week, there was a driver in San Diego who was ticketed for driving while wearing Google Glasses, and ultimately she avoided a traffic citation or traffic conviction because the police couldn't prove that
she had it on.
Yeah, she had it on. So over the weekend, this guy goes to see the new Jack Ryan movie, and about an hour into the movie, he's asked to step out by an agent from ICE and is interviewed, as you said, for about twice as long as the movie itself would have taken. And apparently it all began because there happened to be somebody from the Motion Picture Association in the theater who called it into ICE that there was someone wearing a recording device in the theater. And in response time, which would be impressive for any kind of law enforcement, they managed to get there within, you know, short
period
of time.
I don't think they caught Zazie the New York bomber that
Yeah, day. That was impressive. One can only hope that the response time for more serious crimes is as fast. Ultimately, the suspect, the moviegoer, allowed the agent to search the device, and the agent could see that there was no recording taking place, and he was allowed to leave. Presumably, got a refund and maybe some free popcorn.
I hear he got four tickets to upcoming show.
Right. I'd be surprised if he went back to that theater again. But and ironically, the guy who was wearing the Google glasses does some works with the FBI on cyber cases from time to time. All kidding aside, the crime that the ICE people were investigating is technically called unauthorized recording of motion pictures in a motion picture exhibition facility, which is a felony punishable by up to 3 years in prison. It's traditionally been called camcording, although that term is probably somewhat dated. It could be called iPhoning or Google Glassing now, I suppose. And online distribution of pirated movies is big business. It generates, you know, tens or hundreds of millions of dollars to organize criminal groups, and it often starts with one guy with one recording device in one theater. And the groups that traffic in pirated movies have developed tremendous sophistication at taking these rough videos that are shot by amateurs sitting in theaters, marrying them up with digital audio tracks that they can get from different theaters, and then putting them together and polishing them up so that they have a fairly polished product that they can sell online and make a bunch of money doing it. ICE, actually, although it's best known for immigration, has taken a prominent role, as you alluded to, along with the FBI in pursuing online piracy. ICE actually is the lead agency at something called the National IPR Rights Center, which is in Northern Virginia, and the FBI is their biggest partner. And they've done some creative work going after the groups that do this and trying to make it more difficult for them to make money, including seizing domain names and chasing their assets overseas. I suspect this will become a bigger issue for theaters. There was a statement in one of the news articles from a representative of the theater chain saying it's unacceptable to wear recording device in a theater. And, you know, in the old days, you'd see someone holding up a camcorder, they'd be fairly easy to spot. In the not-so-old days, you see someone holding up a smartphone, and they're still relatively easy to spot if you know what you're looking for. This is a lot harder to spot when someone's just wearing glasses, or they're wearing glasses that are also allowing them to record the movie. So I suspect that you'll see incidents like this, probably not quite as colorful as this, but I think you'll find theater chains and law enforcement really grappling with how to do this, because it doesn't sound like a serious crime, but when you put it in context and you realize that a serious crime is made possible because of something like this, I think it's something that will be with us for a little while.
Okay, well, I think they'll be able to spot Google Glass users doing this too, because the Google Glass users, to get through the movie, will have to bring in a car battery with them.
That's probably right. That's right.
But I have to say, for Homeland Security agents to say, oh yeah, we got plenty of time to go on down to the movie theater and hassle some guy over Google Glass, it's a recipe for getting their budget cut. But maybe Hollywood will ride to their rescue. All right, last point. Snowden claimed, Edward Snowden claimed in a German interview over the weekend that NSA is stealing industrial secrets, gathering information from companies like Siemens that has no national security purpose. I have to say that if there's anything that he has said that I think is just false, at least the implication of what he's saying, that the U.S. government is stealing Siemens secrets and giving it to General Electric, has got to be false. And he was kind of cautious about what he actually said, so maybe he's just doing a kind of teaser for a story that will imply that but won't actually have evidence, because I don't believe that anybody in the intelligence community is doing that, because I don't know anybody in the private community that wants that stuff from them. Jason, any thoughts on that?
I, of all the things that he has said, this is the one I find the hardest to believe.
Yeah. So we'll see. I think he sort of said that he didn't want to step on a story that his journalist buddies were working on, but, you know, when you tell the Germans that the U.S. is engaged in industrial espionage, it's like telling a Jenny Craig weight class that you've got donuts that are no-cal. You know, they just eat it up. They want to believe it so badly. And so he knew that, and I think is doing his best, again, to cause maximum damage to the U.S. In the way he serves up these stories. Okay, that is the end of our roundup, because I would like to get as quickly as possible to our discussion with David Medin. David, are you there?
I'm here.
All right. Thanks for joining us. This is really great. I wanted to start with having produced reports like this myself in government, just how hard this was for a startup organization. How many people actually work at the Oversight Board?
Well, when we started working on this report, which is when I started with the board, we had two detailees, which was our entire staff. Today, as time has gone on, we have six staff members, combination of hires and detailees. So it's been a struggle to get a new agency started and do this report at the same time.
Oh, yeah. This is very difficult to do. While I'm not in agreement with a lot of the content, I have to respect the amount of effort that went into it. So let's jump into the content. In essence, the headline was that the board recommends that the government end the Section 215 program by a vote of 3-2. And then there's a set of additional recommendations to the extent that the program survives, it should be limited to two hops instead of three, there should be higher standards and review for each search, that the retention period for data should go below 5 years. Some stuff on the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, particularly the idea of having outside advocates and a variety of other things. What I'm struck by is, apart from the termination of the program, which obviously the president has decided not to do, is there anything in your report that's really different from what the president announced in his speech? Certainly it doesn't look as though there's anything completely inconsistent with it, but there seem to be a few places where you've gone beyond what the president was saying.
I think there's actually a lot of similarity. I think, as you point out, the biggest headline was that the board, majority of the board, concluded that the current 215 program was not consistent with its authorizing statute, and the White House clearly distanced itself from that position. But if you get beyond that and look at what is being happening or being recommended, I think there's a remarkable similarity. And as Jay Carney said in his press briefing last week, the White House did adopt a number of the board's recommendations. So if you look at our proposal, which is to have an interim period with added privacy protections, and that was a majority view, that's similar to what the president proposed. He recommended going from three hops to two hops. As you know, we added on to that reducing record retention from 5 to 3 years and providing the so-called RAS, or reasonable articulable suspicion determinations, to the court after the fact for review. So there's a very similar there. And on the bulk data program, while he would continue it, the 215 part of it, he also is moving away from the bulk data to some other model of going to providers or to third parties. And again, we recommend it going away from having the NSA maintain bulk data. So I think there's a striking similarity there. And likewise, on the FISC reform, we advocated for a special advocate, which would be a panel of attorneys outside. That's what his approach was as well. So I think there's in many ways a large amount of similarity. And it's no surprise, because the board decided to provide the president with the key sections of our report in draft form as he was undergoing his deliberations, and the entire board met with the president, vice president, and senior staff at the White House, again, before his speech. And so we had an opportunity to discuss both our analysis and our recommendations.
So I'm struck by the – you're right. What you recommend on the special advocates does sound considerably less elaborate than, say, Senator Blumenthal's proposal, which I've described as an advocracy. You're suggesting something where a panel of people who'd be available to be called on by the court for particularly difficult programmatic reviews.
Exactly. We didn't think it made sense to institutionalize that person or entity in the executive or the judicial or the legislative branch, but thought it made sense to have outside private attorneys who could really challenge the government on privacy and civil liberties and statutory compliance grounds.
One of the problems I see there is that the different advocates are going to have different views of the arguments that ought to be made. So one will make one set of arguments, and then the next time that another advocate gets named, he's going to say, "Oh, that idiot! He didn't argue this, and he didn't argue that, and the argument he made is too limited or too aggressive." Having multiple advocates, especially since none of them has a client, is going to produce a whole raft of slightly different takes on these programs, isn't it?
Well, I think we'll see over time if they look to each other for guidance and follow the analysis they take on. But I think that risk exists even if this was this same person or group of people were housed in a government agency. And I think the flip side is they aren't called upon very often. So you're going to have an advocate, if they're employed by the judiciary, say, sitting and twiddling their thumbs two-thirds of the time or more. So I'm not sure that that's a productive way. And also in terms of independence, I guess our view is it was most important to have someone outside the government.
Oh, yeah, it would be crazy to have somebody just sitting around waiting for this. Let me ask this. There's a whole bunch of career officials who are staff to the FISC, and they exist to play this role at bottom. I mean, they're not there just to... to say, oh, yeah, great, another great proposal for an order from the government. They have to think that their job is to find things that are wrong with the government's orders or with the government's legal theories. Why isn't that enough?
Well, I think they do the FISC staff do a tremendous job, and you're right, their job is to raise questions. But ultimately, they are not, I think, as dedicated to the privacy and civil liberties issues, constitutional challenges, than an outside person would be. I mean, their role is really to facilitate the court process and to make sure the government papers are correct and to push back where they think the judge might push back as well. And so they perform an enormously valuable role, but we think it would be beneficial to have an outside party in to raise, quite honestly, a lot of the kinds of issues that we have raised in our report in the FISC proceedings.
So should we have the same procedures when people want wiretap orders against the mafia or domestic groups? Right now, you know, we don't provide a lawyer to argue essentially in favor of the rights of the mafia. Given the rationale of your proposal, shouldn't we do the same thing there?
No. Our proposal is that the special advocate is only appropriate in cases involving novel, technical, or legal issues, and that would be largely programmatic approvals, although it could involve individual approvals where there's some unique technology. But in the everyday case where, as you say, a mafia or some other order is being sought, we think the judges are very well equipped to handle those. We've heard from two judges, former judges, from the FISC at our public events and also met privately with a third former FISC judge and got a clear sense, that they didn't need assistance in those everyday cases, which, you know, as you know, judges around the country issue ex parte search warrants all the time and do so very expertly. So it was really more the area where the judges themselves have said that they could use help where they're involving new programs or new technology.
One of the things I didn't see in the President's discussion that I did see in your report was this notion that the FISC ought to be appointing more special masters or ought to feel free to appoint more special masters. And here's my worry on that. I think the court the FISC is already probably over the line in terms of what we should be asking Article III judges to do. They're no longer engaged in resolving cases and controversies. They're managing these programs in a very real sense. Now, maybe only some of the legal and civil liberties implications of the programs, but they are dealing with them day in and day out, engaged in negotiations with the government over exactly how they're going to be done, and then trying to enforce their will when they think that their guidance wasn't followed. Very much a managerial role, not a judicial role. And it seems to me that appointing a special master is another step down the road toward taking over executive functions. How do you use special masters without falling prey to that temptation?
Well, I guess a couple of reactions. I don't subscribe to the fact this is sort of beyond the judges, but I think the judges themselves have called out and said we could use help in this process, and we really wanted to give them an array of tools to use. A lot of it is in the technology area. We want to make sure that the judges are up to speed and can raise the appropriate questions and to call upon technologists. They can already question the government's witnesses and technology experts, but we think in some cases it would be helpful for them to get outside assistance. And I think ultimately, you know, Congress can play a role here, and if Congress circumscribes some of these procedures and make clearly authorize some of the programs, that will take some of the managerial parts of the judge's role away.
Yeah, well, it's certainly true that I think there was that one opinion that said that the NSA interpretation of the order strained credulity, which almost certainly was a lawyer who had no clue how the technology worked, approaching the problem as a legal problem, whereas the technologists were approaching it as a technology program, and they saw a pretty clear difference between doing a technical scrub on the way in and allowing people access to the database. He said, "Oh, I can't possibly, couldn't possibly have believed that in good faith." But to someone who has some technical familiarity, NSA's interpretation was pretty plausible until it was shot down by the FISC. So a little more technical sophistication would help, but I think saying that we should give them help to administer these programs means that we really are doubling down on giving them an administrative role, and that's got to be the wrong answer.
Well, that's... Yeah, then it's up to Congress if you believe that to more clearly guide how these programs operate. But for now, that has been left to the FISC to manage as the government has made applications. And again, we just want to make sure that as they do that, they have the benefit of both a special advocate in appropriate cases, as well as technological expertise.
The rest of the stuff that you talked about, more transparency, and certainly the president talked about that, although I don't think he said, as you did, that the board itself should be fully informed about everything that happens in FISA, including the classified reports to Congress. Would you be like the third, the eighth, the 12th oversight body that is charged with worrying about civil liberties in connection with NSA activities? Why is it that the PCOB needs to be brought into this if the FISC and the Justice Department and the Inspector General for the DNI, for NSA, the General Counsel's Office at NSA, all of them think they have a responsibility to worry about civil liberties? Why do we need to disclose sensitive national security issues to yet another body?
Well, of course, that's Congress created us for just that purpose, is to oversee federal counterterrorism programs and how they address privacy and civil liberties. So it only makes sense that we be in the loop on the reporting function so that we can be aware of what's going on. Some of the entities you mentioned don't have as their primary focus privacy and civil liberties balance with national security. We do. And so that's not to say that we will get involved in every one of those, but if there's a reporting function, we would absolutely benefit from seeing those reports and then making a determination about which programs we would want to oversee more closely.
Well, having had clients who were on the receiving end of leaked classified programs right after oversight hearings. I'm sensitive to this. The idea of providing details about these programs to yet another group of staff and full and part-time board members, there needs to be a pretty good reason to do that on a routine basis. But I can see your view of the PCLOP's role, but it does seem to me that if we're going to start actually getting control of classified information, we need to reduce the number of people who are learning about these secrets, not increase it.
Well, I would just add that, as you may know, all of the board members and all of the staff have a top secret SCI clearance. Our entire office is a SCIF. And we take very seriously our responsibilities about handling classified information. And we are charged with overseeing these programs. And so it only makes sense that we should have access to it. And I'm not sure this is not really the place to start cutting back on who should have access to classified programs if we're going to effectively carry out our oversight function.
Okay, so let me ask about the oversight function. You briefed the president, if I remember, in early December, but didn't release the report until the 24th of January, after which the president had pretty much taken his position. So you, to the extent that you wanted to influence the public debate prior to the president's speech, you sort of missed the opportunity. And I wonder whether you're, you know, obviously you had some influence on the president before he gave that speech, but nobody else knew that you were recommending a termination of the program until after he'd made it clear he wasn't going to get rid of it. Do you have some plans for sort of trying to become a little more timely now that you've got more staff and at least one of these things under your belt?
Well, let me take that up in two ways. One is I'm not at all concerned about the chronology here. It was actually in January that we briefed the president and vice president on our report, really just shortly before it came out. And we have a statutory mission to advise the executive branch. And so in carrying that out, we thought it was important to provide them an advance copy of the report. And we had a very extensive discussion in the White House Situation Room about it. And so we thought that was important. But you asked in terms of the public and Congress, we've now released our report shortly after the president's speech. And so both the public and Congress can evaluate our analysis and our recommendations along with his and others and propose legislation all at the same time. So we think we entered the fray at a very good time.
All right. My view is you would have been more effective if you'd gotten it out in early January, but
And as you say, staff resources certainly made it a challenge to get it out. We had people working till 4 in the morning, site checking and getting the report.
I've done this and I know what it's like. I mean, you have to do your own damn site checking.
Exactly. We have no other. But anyway, I think I'm actually comfortable. The chronology of Congress is now just taking up the matter. We've been invited to testify next month in a couple of hearings, and so I think we've entered the public debate at a very good time. Whether it was a week before or a week after the president, I think it's more important that we all be out there and have our views considered.
Okay. One of my perceptions is you spent a lot of time writing what I have called an amicus brief on the law, and one that I found unpersuasive. And in fact, I have to say, I think the lack of persuasiveness of what is the longest section in the entire report attacking the statutory basis for the program actually sort of infects the rest of the report. To my mind, reading this, you come to the conclusion that the drafter of that section of the report was going to throw everything, credible or incredible, at the program to show that it was illegal. And my favorite example, and you're not surprised by this because you've seen my blog post on this, is the attack on the reenactment doctrine, which says, Congress actually extended the sunset after extensive debate and making changes to 215. Extended the program twice with lots and lots of members committee chairs, two committees in both houses briefed on this, and a number of the members briefed on it. They all had the opportunity, in many cases, did know how the program worked. And the usual rule is, well, when Congress does that, you assume they are adopting the administrative and judicial interpretations that have gone into the program before that. And your report says, oh, that rule doesn't apply, doesn't trump the plain meaning of a law. And this is, I find that kind of gobsmacking. The interpretation that the board adopted, it adopted 3-2, so it's a bare majority of the board. If you look at the judicial interpretations of this, there are probably 15 judges that have already said, yeah, we think it fits the statute, and one who has said it doesn't. And so those 15 judges, they're just really stupid because they don't even raise a point of ambiguity about this. How can you come to a conclusion that the plain meaning is on the side of three board members and one district judge? I just don't get it.
Well, you've raised a lot of questions. Let me address some of them. Again, we think for a number of grounds the statute doesn't comply with 215, and we think reenactment doesn't save it. For starters, as our report revealed for the first time, there was never a judicial opinion regarding this program until 2013. And so the notion that, because you had mentioned judicial interpretations, there was never a discussion of how this program fit or didn't fit under 215 until 2013. There was no discussion on whether the program implicated the Electronic Communications Privacy Act until 2013, long after these reenactments. And so there is no notion that Congress was aware of judicial opinions because there weren't any prior to then. And as you also point out, you said some of the members were briefed, some of the members were not briefed. And so Congress did not have a full awareness of the program. And the courts also don't accept reenactment on its face. The voting rights case, Shelby versus Holder, the court looked behind reenactment and said, what was Congress really looking at? And so it's not an automatic rule that just because Congress reenacts a statute that it somehow adopts not even printed opinions, not to mention some that were certainly not made widely public as well. So, obviously you're free to differ with our conclusion, but we didn't think that saved the statute as applied in this particular program.
I take your point that there weren't written opinions, but of course there wasn't much of a reason to write down opinions if the only people who really needed to know what the judge had decided were the people running the program. I'm confident you wouldn't say that the FISC would decide to approve a program of this significance without thinking about whether it's legally justified.
But that's in large part why we've called for a more adversary process with a special advocate. You can't imagine a court, not a non-FISC court, having a decision of this momentousness of gathering phone records on almost every American and not have a fully considered opinion. But you're right, there was no other side there who could argue and then give the judge a reason to publish an opinion. And so we think this is an issue that won't be as much of a problem going forward, because there will be a special advocate there, I would think, in this kind of case, who can then raise all these issues, and then the judge would write a considered opinion. As Judge Robertson told us at our hearing over the summer, he would read one side's brief and say, that makes a lot of sense, and then he'd read the other side's brief and says, I see the problem there. That was all missing from the court process. And so,
did you get briefs on whether this notion that the plain meaning of the law was clear in this case, that there was no justification? Did you guys get briefs on that?
We've read every administration brief that's been written. The administration's white paper, its FISC applications, its court filings, all the judicial opinions, and so we've read everything the administration has argued on the legality of this program.
And was the notion that the law was so plain that it couldn't possibly be interpreted the way 15 judges have interpreted it, was that presented to the Justice Department and a brief written in response to it? Because you, that's what you rely on here, and I just don't how you can call that the plain meaning and say there's no ambiguity when practically every judge that's looked at it has gone the other way. I just don't understand.
Well, except those judges didn't have the benefit of an opposing argument.
Oh, and you, so you're just harder than they are.
No. No, judges, quite the opposite. Judges, I mean, we heard from the judges again and again, is we judge best when we hear both sides, and we can then draw our own conclusions. That's just what something what Judge Robertson said. Each side on their own is very persuasive. It's the engagement, and which makes it is our whole function of our adversary system, is to hear both sides. And so we absolutely don't think we're smarter than all these Article III judges. We just think that we've had the benefit, and in the future they will have the benefit of hearing both
so
sides.
The Southern District of New York got full briefing and came down on
it. Well, and they're entitled to that. That's our system, and then they get appealed, and then ultimately perhaps the Supreme Court will decide.
Do you have a mind about whether there might be ambiguity in this statute that would allow the reenactment doctrine to come into play? That's you just dismiss it.
No, I don't think we're saying there's ambiguity. I don't think we're saying there's ambiguity about the reenactment doctrine. I think we're saying there's ambiguity about the application of the statute to this program.
You're saying there's none, because you're saying the plain meaning is that...
Right, but I don't think that the judges didn't take on the statutory argument in district court, other than in dicta. In dicta. They said that it's really relegated to the FISC, but then they did some engage in some dicta on the statutory side.
Okay. I'll leave it there, because we're not going to persuade each other, but I will say... that and some of the other reaches in this legal analysis really raise questions about whether the board was approaching this with an open mind or whether it was determined to reach a result. And it seems to me that when you write a brief like that, you're going to expose yourself to that kind of doubt, because people can evaluate the legal analysis in ways they can't evaluate your review of the classified information. And I wonder whether you really want to be writing legal opinions of this sort, since you could have raised all these issues in the context of saying, look, there are a lot of hard issues here, and that informs our decision on whether the program should continue. You would have had a unanimous opinion, and frankly, there'd be fewer doubts about whether you started out where you ended up or whether you arrived at it by carefully looking at the program.
Let me just quickly respond. One is I'm speaking for myself, and I think this is true for the other board members and the majority. I did not come to this with any conclusions. I had an extremely open mind about it and spent months and months considering it, and only after reviewing the administration's white paper and our legal analysis and the other materials came to a conclusion. So it was not at all as though this was a prejudged case at all. And then with regard to our role here, our statute specifically says that we're supposed to do two things when we evaluate programs. One is, do they appropriately protect privacy and civil liberties? And the other is, are they consistent with governing laws? And so we felt that Congress had directed us to make that determination.
Okay, better late than never, I guess, would be the attitude. Let me ask you two final questions. First, you heard Edward Snowden come as close as I think he dared to accusing the National Security Agency of engaging in industrial espionage. Do you have any reason to believe that the U.S. government or that the National Security Agency or indeed the intelligence community engages in industrial espionage to benefit competitors in the United States?
You know, I mean, I'm not going to be in the business of confirming or denying reports about the NSA, so I'll have to leave that to others to address.
Okay. So last question, then. You made it clear that your next project is 702, also known as PRISM. Obviously, that was raised by some of the very first leaks from Snowden, and it became part of the debate, and then gradually people realized, well, this is Section 702. It's what we debated and passed. before in a big and widely debated congressional review. Can you tell me why you postponed it and what we should be expecting in terms of, obviously not the results, but the scope and the nature of the review?
Sure. We actually conducted a study of both the 215 and 702 programs over the last several months. We had briefings, meetings with respective agencies, reviewed FISC decisions. And so we've actually done a fair amount of the work that we need to do on the 702 program. We just came to a point in the fall, given our limited staff, and decided that it was better to get out one report sooner than two reports a lot later. And so we just devote our resources after having conducted a study of both programs to writing up the 215 program. And so now we're going to turn to 702. And in terms of approach, it'll be similar structure, which is to look at the legal basis for the program, consider whether there are any constitutional issues, and look at the privacy and civil liberties implications of the program and how they relate to the national security benefits of the program.
I should say, you concluded that the 215 program was constitutional unanimously, if I remember right.
Well, we said that under the Fourth Amendment, Smith v. Maryland is the law of the land today, and so on that basis, until the Supreme Court changes its views about the Fourth Amendment in that case, that the program is consistent with the Fourth Amendment. On the First Amendment, we didn't reach a conclusion about it, whether it was consistent with the First Amendment. What we said is that there are certainly some serious First Amendment issues here, which informed our policy decisions.
Okay, so didn't find it unconstitutional, but you, at least three of you, were holding your noses at the time.
Well, we see the trend, as you know, in the Jones case and some of the concurring opinions, as raising questions about the third-party doctrine under the Fourth Amendment, and some questions about whether this scope of collection has greater implications than an individual surveillance program of a particular person. And so we think that that these are all open questions for the Supreme Court to consider in the future.
Yeah, no, I think that I think you're right. If the cell phones are the Vietnam of the Roberts Court, third-party doctrine is going to be its Bien Phu. Thank you so much for coming on, and because you knew you were not going to have a completely easy ride. It was very thoughtful, very civil, and credit to the board. That's David Medin. Thank you so much for coming on, and we'll invite you on again after your 702 report.
Sounds good. Always a pleasure, Stuart. Take care.
All right. Great to talk to you. And now, you thought it was over, but in fact, as I've said, this podcast is sponsored by Steptoe & Johnson, and so there's going to be a brief word from our sponsor to announce something I'm really delighted to announce, which is that Steptoe & Johnson is finally, after 20 years of lobbying by Stuart Baker, opening an office in Palo Alto, and luckily with lawyers considerably more talented and relevant to most of what Silicon Valley does than Stuart Baker. We are opening on Page Mill Road, and we'll have a substantial group of intellectual property and patent litigators led by Bill Abrams in the office. The shrimp has not been served, the office warming has not occurred, but we are open for business, and I couldn't be happier since I've been trying to get that to happen since I was working for Netscape back in the early 90s. It's a pleasure, and that is the news from our sponsor. Thanks to everyone for participating in this, Chris Conti, Jason Weinstein, and David Medin. We hope you will join us next week for insights into the latest events in technology, security, privacy, and government. That closes Episode 4 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe & Johnson. For more information, visit our website at www.steptoecyberblog.com.